Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Before tariffs disrupted the Canadian market, the wine brand Bread and Butter shipped to 44 countries and was approaching 2 million cases. It's become one of the fastest growing wine brands globally, resonating particularly with younger modern consumers through its Don't Overthink It campaign. It's a message that's proven so effective, it's been widely copied. The brand is part of the US company WX Brands, the Nevada-based company that started as Winery Exchange in 1999. Now, while WX built its business producing private label wines, beers and spirits for major retailers, it has strategically acquired its own branded portfolio over the past decade. In 2017, WX purchased Bread and Butter when the brand was already being called, quote, one of the hottest brands in the wine industry, and it grew 70% that year alone. Since then, the brand has flourished under the leadership of Caitlin Vartain Ward, who serves as its brand director. In this conversation, Caitlin offers consumer insights behind the Don't Overthink It campaign, why buttery Chardonnay drinkers remain remarkably loyal, and how the brand successfully navigates everything from Swedish consumers to low alcohol innovations, all while maintaining its price in a market where many brands are racing to the bottom. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Now, you are in charge of Bread and Butter. Can you talk a little about the brand? Who is the consumer? How is it sold? Anything that you would like to just introduce it with?
So Bread and Butter is actually interesting because it's a very big global brand. We've done a very good job of building it in key wine drinking countries. And across the board, what we see is that it has attracted a younger, more modern consumer that's looking for a modern look, a modern flavor, and the way we market the wine is very modern. So we're trying to speak to consumers directly. And I think those three elements have been key to our success.
All right, let's jump straight into that. So you're talking about the consumer that everybody wants, but everybody is frightened that they're not drinking and their habits are changing. What are you actually seeing among all the noise?
So one thing is, wine feels very complicated to, I think, all consumers, but especially to a younger consumer that has more choices. Like seltzers might seem more straightforward, but what we've done with Bread and Butter through our Don't Overthink It campaign is really talk to them about easy occasions to enjoy wine, helping them unlock it, seeing that it's not complicated, that the flavor doesn't have to be complicated. Even our winemaker, we have this quote from her that's a good wine is a wine you like. So it's not that like a consumer needs to understand Pinot Noir is from a cool climate and, you know, how it's grown. It's more of like how you can enjoy it and unlock that experience. And the truth is, if you like it, then it's good. And it really just demystifies wine for them. We have a new video ad that's been quite a hit here in the US. It was just released maybe a month ago, and it's also a hit in Canada already. And what it is that we start out in this like dark environment, very like, it's like people tasting wine. They're like wine, sipping, swirling, and it feels very just like dark and a scary world to be in. And then we move into like a beautiful world with Bread and Butter. And it says Bread and Butter is easy and for every day and for every occasion. And this like contrast of these two worlds brings the consumer into this modern moment where we remind them like wine's meant to be simply enjoyed. It's not about the swirling. If you want to swirl, great. If you want to like do something else with it, you can do that too. But it's really about like having it with food, having it with friends, having it at the beach, just those easy occasions.
Okay, let's go right back to the beginning. So you've been involved, or I think you started the Don't Overthink It campaign, which has been widely copied. How did that insight come out? Where did it come from? And can you talk about the process of bringing a campaign like that to life?
So we launched the Don't Overthink It campaign in 2020, at the end of 2020. So think about that time period. It was COVID. People were in this COVID mindset. And we did some research. And across the board, what we already knew in our hearts and what we saw in the research is just that consumers feel that wine is complicated. And even picking a wine in the store is complicated. I always say in grocery stores in America, like, it is so challenging for the consumer because it's not brand blocked. It's blocked by varietal, right? And they don't know always Pinot Noir versus Cabernet. And, you know, you see people just looking mystified in the grocery store. So we wanted the campaign to bring that to life, to say, like, it doesn't have to be complicated to choose wine, and then it doesn't have to be complicated to drink it. And so the consumer insights led us to just demystifying wine for the consumer, making it easy for them. We liked Don't Overthink It because it rolls off the tongue. And it also felt very relevant in that COVID time period, like where you're overthinking everything. We did think about evolving it this past year, and we actually tested it again. And what we found was that the key insight was even more relevant than before. Like, consumers still feel it's complicated, and they liked the simplicity of the statement.
One of the thing about marketing campaigns is sometimes the very intuitive ideas, like just do it or whatever, actually come out of quite a lot of research and testing, and quite a lot of advertising brains go into it. Yep. So it feels intuitive, but often there's a lot of work behind it. Did you discard insights? How did you come to this very simple insight? Did you brainstorm it? Did you sit up all night? Where did it come from? Do you remember?
I would say the root of it was I'm very good friends with our winemaker. She's a veteran winemaker, been around the industry for years. And one thing that we always felt was we would go to parties and people would stick their wines in our face and say, is this a good wine? Is this a good wine? And both of us separately on our own would respond, do you like it? If you like it, then it's a good wine. And so I think everything was kind of rooted around that. We felt like people were anxious. They can't even settle in at a party and trust themselves to enjoy that wine. And then the consumer research just really echoed that. And even we did more consumer research the other day. And one thing consumers were saying us across the board was like, there's just so much wine to choose from in these stores, and they don't always know what the things on the label mean. Like, people have asked me, does the vintage, should it be newer or older?
Right?
And it's different. White wines you should choose a newer vintage. Red wine's okay to choose an older. Or, you know, at a certain price point, it just doesn't really matter. And we just felt that that was really echoed in every part of the research. The packaging could be more clear, right? The way we communicate about wine could be more clear. And I think the big thing that it came down to and what has been consistent about the campaign is we talk to the consumer about them. We don't talk about ourselves, right? Like, it's about how we can support them in their lives and unlock those easy moments. But like, a lot of brands these days and traditionally have talked about heritage and that, and that can be compelling to a certain consumer. But for us, it's like, we're here to unlock your easy moments. It's about you. It's about bringing you happiness, you moments of joy. So I think that's been really powerful.
A lot has happened in the world since 2020. We're almost living in a different era than we were then. What have you noticed in terms of the way the consumer mindset has changed? Are you seeing more price sensitivity, more experimentation, more conservatism, less drinking? What are you seeing?
So the first thing, and we've just launched an evolution of the campaign, the first thing that we've done and seen is, in 2020, when we launched, a lot of people were concerned about, like, the world felt really tough. It felt really kind of like dark. And they were using wine as a way to like unlock moments as they came back from COVID. And so a lot of the campaign was around like, wine helping to unlock your ease and make those awkward moments less awkward. Now, when we've tested the campaign, what we've really seen is that people just want to joyful experience. They want to use wine to unlock joy with themselves, with their partner, with their friends. And then in 2025 now, we're going into 2026. I hear a lot of like the consumers trading down to a lower price point. I don't see that in the data at all. Not in the US. I don't see that. It is happening a little bit in Canada, that, but that's mostly because the U.S. wines are the more premium option and they are off the shelf right now. But in the U.S., we're not seeing consumers trade down. And I, years ago, worked with like other CPG companies, and I worked with a cupcake company. And one thing the owner said to me was, even when times are tough, people still buy cupcakes. Because it's it's not a trip to Mexico, right? It's something that brings joy into their daily life. And I've been seeing that a lot with wine. Like, bread and butter is still, you know, growing. People are still choosing it. I'm not letting our sales team dip into pricing below what I think is equitable for the brand, because I see no need. And also, I do see consumers still reaching for what we call ultra premium here in the US, which is the $15 to $20 price category. And there's a lot of like Cabernets growing in that price category. So it's just not what I'm seeing.
So I should have asked you at the beginning, can you talk about the price points, the SKUs, and can you give me some sense of the volume of the brand?
Yes, I can. So the brand was nearing 2 million cases prior to Canada being closed on a global level. And Canada, when Canada closed to U.S. wines, Bread and Butter was the number one U.S. brand in Canada and the number four brand overall, and it was growing faster than the top brand. So we thought we would be number one overall maybe this year. We're excited for Canada to reopen and for Bread and Butter to re-enter, but that gives you an idea of how big Bread and Butter is on the global landscape.
Actually,
and
then I want to keep talking about the brand, and I want to keep talking about the marketing, but let's do a divergence into Canada. Was that a shock to your system? And what do you think is likely to happen?
It was a shock. And I think the saddest part for me is that the brand has such love there. We have a tasting room in Napa, and we have Canadian consumers coming to visit us on a weekly basis, telling us how much they miss the brand.
Really?
And we track equity in Canada. It is just a beloved brand in Canada. We've done a really good job expanding distribution, but the consumer has driven that pull. And through the Don't Overthink It campaign, through the partnerships that we've had in Canada, I think it's just been resonant with that consumer. It was a shock. It's still a shock. But we're excited to return when, you know, the monopolies allow that and communicate directly to the consumer in a positive way.
It's really interesting with that dynamic. And of course, nobody knows what's going to happen and how long it's going to last. How do you maintain awareness in a market like that? Are you attempting to maintain awareness?
We do have a Prosecco that's still in the market because it comes from Italy. So that is one way that we've maintained awareness. I will say buy rates of consumers can vary between 30 and 60 days. So while this year has felt like a long time for me as a marketer, as a brand owner, for the average consumer, like some of them aren't even aware that Bread and Butter has been gone.
Interesting.
I was coming back from Canada myself, and I was working on the airplane, and I had my computer had Bread and Butter on it. And the woman next to me said, "I love that brand. I haven't been able to find it. What happened?"
Interesting.
She didn't even know about the tariffs and, you know, all the larger political environment. So I think that's important for marketers across the board to remember, is that the consumer is not as engaged in the political dynamics impacting your industry. And also just you know, the category. They're not like tracking wine category trends like we are. They're just going to the store to buy wine when they want it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'm going to come back to the whole marketing thing, because I think it's interesting. Yep. So you've got this fantastic, brand background. What do you think you've taken from other areas that wine people really should spend more time thinking about?
I think, unfortunately, the way wine has been marketed the last 15 to 20 years, I kind of said this before, but they've talked a lot about themselves, right? Yeah. Like we've gone into like history, legacy, where the vineyards are. And I love wine and I love those types of stories, but not every consumer resonates with that. Like many consumers want to understand the usage occasions, how they should enjoy it. And it doesn't have to be complicated. It literally is like, they want to know why they should choose a Pinot Noir for that meal over Cabernet, like really breaking it down into the easy, accessible thing.
So how do you communicate that? How do you communicate this is what you need with dinner versus this?
So we have started our ampersand, which is very central to our branding, has started playing a key role in our marketing. Okay. And you'd see that in our video ads and our digital ads and the way we come to life at an event or in print. And it's to connect high and low moments or high and low pairings. So we have an image of our Pinot Noir with a popsicle, a strawberry popsicle, and then a strawberry fruit. And it's just to remind them, like, I'm not going to explain to them, strawberry is a note in Pinot Noir. And that's too complicated, but that imagery is like so simple for the consumer to think of, like, oh, I'm going to have strawberry cake tonight. I should have.
Okay, so once again, talking about using the ampersand, that is actually a very sophisticated advertising strategy. Do you have an agency you work with, or is this all coming out of your brain?
We do. We have our agency of record is called Argonaut. They're San Francisco based.
It's a great name.
Yeah, they are. And they're actually the ones that pulled out the ampersand and directed us to use it. We had always felt a special connection to it, but we didn't know the how. And so they really showed us like ways to bring it to life. And I think our video ad, it also pulls out the ampersand at the end. And it's like bread and butter is for every day and every way and da da da.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually very clever. I haven't seen it, but just from the description, I mean, it's simple, it's distinctive, it's, you know, part of the brand asset. That's great. So, okay, so you've done this research and you understand the consumer. What messages don't resonate? You've said don't talk about yourself and heritage, but when you've tested different messages, what are the ones that just go, no?
I keep going back to it, but anything too complicated is lost on them. If it's like this to this to this to this, it's just not how they digest information, especially in this world of like social media, sound bites. It just has to be a really simple, clear message. And, you know, what we came to overarchingly is like, if the takeaway from an ad unit isn't bread and butter is easy, then that ad isn't working for us. And so that's what we look for when we test. We also think of social media, our organic social media. And when I say organic, I mean things we haven't put money behind as a testing ground. And we actually see that the posts that are the most engaging are the ones that have that ampersand into it and connect like two very simple ideas. It's an easy get, it's memorable, and I think we all can relate to this, but high-low is also emotional too. Like you use wine for your daily occasion. That is a highly emotional experience, but you also use it for high experiences too, like taking it to a party, to your friend's birthday. And those are the moments you remember on a weekly basis.
Okay, so going back to the audience, I mean, there is a huge body of research at the moment that younger people are drinking differently than their predecessors did. And when I talk to people in the States, they often say to me, oh, yeah, but Gen Z hasn't reached all legal drinking age yet. And I go, yeah, but internationally they have, and we're seeing these things. So when you talk to people, when you do this research, do you have any insights into why the pattern has changed so much?
I mean, the truth of the industry and the larger ecosystem is people have more choices now. And in America too, like 10 years ago, I went to the beach in Santa Barbara and I was shocked at the number of seltzers. And now what shocks me is that the younger generation is bringing those to dinner parties, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And bringing them to their gatherings. And I'm like, why wouldn't you just bring wine? It's ready to drink too. But I think, and I hope Bread and Butter spearheads this and encourages other brands to do the same. It's going back to capturing those occasions, not just for alcohol, but it could be like a marijuana occasion that wine can capture too. Really, again.
Okay, that is a cool idea. Nobody has suggested that to me. That is a
Well, that's, you know, that is the truth. Like, people are choosing marijuana for occasions that could be an alcohol occasion and could be a wine occasion. And to put it in simple terms, so my husband is European. Bread and Butter is a central part of our love story, if you will, because it's so big in Sweden.
You can't dangle that out there. What happened?
Bread and Butter Pinot Noir is the number one most consumed wine in Sweden. The brand has a huge affinity there. Yeah. And if you think about it, it makes sense because the label really fits their aesthetic. But when I talk to people in Sweden, they also say, again, like we see on a global level, they feel it's a more modern brand for someone like them, right? Like my sister-in-law, who's my age, that's what she says. That's how she feels. And that is what the research tells us too. But he came from Sweden to the US. He knew Bread and Butter. We met online. I had a picture of me with Bread and Butter. And he was just so excited that I knew the brand. And then I worked on the brand. And then at our wedding, there was much Bread and Butter there. The Swedes were very happy. And
because they all thought they could get a discount.
They do. They also get to try things before they release and meet the winemakers. So they're very happy about that.
Okay, so this raises a question I hadn't thought of. Systembolaget doesn't list things unless they have sustainability credentials. So you must have quite good sustainability credentials. Can you talk about that?
We are actually working on that. Everything from Bread and Butter is vinted and bottled in Napa Valley, which cues like an expertise in winemaking, which cues, you know, that we care about the way we make wine. And we have actually been working very diligently to have the wine say on the label certified sustainable. It's not an easy process. It is getting easier because many vineyards in California are getting the certifications. But I think what's happened, and it's beyond California, it's on a global level, like a lot of small growers, it's an expense for them to get their grapes certified. And we do buy grapes from growers across the state. But there is a shift. It's not that they haven't been farming their vineyards in a sustainable way. It's that they never paid for the certification before, and we've been putting that pressure to, you know, have them do that so we can clearly state what we do to the consumer on the label.
Okay, so let's talk about international markets. How many markets are you in, and how do you, just answer the question, how many markets are you in?
We ship to 44 countries right now.
And how do you decide, okay, here's a market, we should go there? What's that process?
So we are part of a larger organization. It's one of the brands that we own is called Trapiche, and that is also
a very large and famous Argentine company.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we've seen the markets where we have good sales channels through Trapiche and have opened that. But one thing I think that Bread and Butter has done really, really well is focused on the big wine drinking regions that aren't dominated by their own wines. For example, it's very hard for Bread and Butter to enter France with California wines because they have so much French wines. But Sweden, we knew we could have success there. And what we've seen is that actually being from California speaks to the younger consumer because they associate old world with their parents' wine and they're looking to the new world for a wine that's for someone like them.
That's interesting. That's actually, you know, there's a lot of Italian labels that design them as if they're from California, especially the sort of Zinfandel style, specifically for that reason. That's really interesting. Okay, so, but now comes the question. You've offered UK consumers a new lower alcohol version. Mm-hmm. So how do you keep your brand integrity when the taste expectations are different for different markets?
And we actually offer sliced in the US, Canada, and the UK. So, and it is starting to make its way into other countries as well. One thing about Chardonnay, and it's interesting in the US, but a lot of brands have started to market both a buttery Chardonnay and a non-buttery Chardonnay. Our Chardonnay is buttery. It is balanced. But, you know, and we don't have another Chardonnay here. So what we thought of when we thought of slice was we still wanted it to have some traditional elements of bread and butter, but we were okay with it being a little less buttery, a little less creamy, a little bit more refreshing. The winemakers worked really hard. We benchmarked against the competitive set, and we did not stop until we had a flavor that we were proud of. I will say with sliced, we are proud of the name. We think it's like very ownable cool. to bread and butter. But also what it does is it has consumer empathy because it's a very unique package. It's not just that we've added sliced on the label. It has a very different label from bread and butter Chardonnay. So you know what you're choosing. And one thing we've seen with the low alc category in the US is that a lot of the packages look near identical to their hero SKU, and the consumer is getting confused and choosing the wrong one off the shelf. And even the merchandiser gets confused and put the wrong one in the shelf. So we feel we've had consumer empathy in the way we've packaged it, the way we market it. And we also are proud of the flavor. For our hero Chardonnay, we say buttery yet balanced. For spice, we say
So once again, this thing light. About... This thing about brand distinctiveness and not getting reshelved, that's actually a very key insight. How did you come to that? Was it testing, or did you walk through retail and go, oh, here's a problem? Like, how did you know to do it differently?
I think there were a few things at play. We were not the first to market for low alc, so we were seeing what we thought were brands not doing it correctly. And again, not having that consumer empathy. We did want a unique pack. We thought with low alc, we could be a little cheeky, which is true to the brand. We think Slice is a very cheeky name and memorable. One thing that you said earlier is like, we really wanted to protect the equity of the hero SKU too, and have it be distinct. Mm-hmm. The Chardonnay is our first SKU that we ever produced. It is the number one, was the number one Chardonnay in Canada. It is a fast-growing buttery Chardonnay here. It is a top Chardonnay in the premium segment in the UK. So we just didn't want that consumer to be confused. And we wanted to reduce the risk of cannibalization, obviously, as well.
So just on the butteriness, one of the most interesting things is when I was a magazine editor of a consumer magazine, it was very hard to get writers to write about buttery Chardonnay because, you know, the connoisseur view is that it all should be lean and you know, whatever. Yeah. But consumers absolutely adore this buttery thing that they can't. I mean, I know at one point there was too many, you know, about 30 years ago. Why this incredible disconnect, do you think?
The loyalty for buttery Chardonnays is through the roof. If you look at household penetration, it's low. But those consumers who do buy it are loyal. And when I look at the data in the U.S., Chardonnay is the most loyal category. Like, Chardonnay drinkers don't overlap into other varietals at the same rate as Cabernet drinkers or Sauvignon Blanc drinkers. And then within Chardonnay, they're very, very brand loyal because they care about certain styles. So, you know, I think about our Chardonnay and our bread and butter Chardonnay was made to compete with butter. And the way they did the formula was they wanted it to be buttery yet balanced. So again, like, if you don't love buttery Chardonnays, but you love Chardonnay, we still think you will like ours. And if you love buttery Chardonnays, we know you will love ours.
So how do you know when you've got the level right? And does the level ever change? Do some years you go, oh, okay, people are eating more vegetables, maybe we'll lower the butteriness. I mean, how do you keep track of the taste profile?
So we have a very, very rigorous benchmarking process that we do with our winemakers, and they taste for every bottling, they taste previous vintages to make sure the house style is coming through. And this is not specific to Chardonnay, it's across the board. We will likely do some formula testing next year on a few key SKUs. We do like to benchmark them and make sure the consumer is still responding and that sentiment hasn't changed. But the previous research that I have seen, again, shows what I have just said, that consumers like the buttery and they perceive it as being more balanced.
And I just want to pick up on something else you said, where you said about the loyalty to Chardonnay. I had never, ever thought about that. But is there a clear difference between the Sauvignon Blanc drinker and the Chardonnay drinker? Is there crossover, or do you tend to go for one style and you stick it? What are you seeing in terms of loyalty to a style of wine?
So what we look at is we look at buyer overlap. So typically, someone has a favorite varietal. And for me, it's Pinot Noir. It's where I go through to first in the store. But then after that, I go to Sauvignon Blanc, right? And that's okay. The overlap. So I come in through Pinot Noir. I buy three bottles. Then I buy one of Sauvignon Blanc. And that's the data that we look at. And what we see with Chardonnay is they're more likely to stop at Chardonnay, right? Like they're more like, they're not going to the other varietals as much.
That's so interesting.
As other drinkers, yeah.
Do you know anything more about them? Is this somebody that is more likely to be, you know, conservative in other tastes, you know, less adventurous? Do you have any sense of what the person behind the taste is?
The only data that I have is that it tends to lean female and more Gen X, you know, like 40 plus. I do think the younger consumer is more adventurous and willing to try different things. And it's funny because you would think that they really are looking for a food pairing. But in my personal life, what I've seen is people who gravitate to that style, they just never through the night switch to a different wine.
It like, just does the job. I've actually seen that. I have seen people who love that style, who've walked in and you know, sniffed something else and go, nope, I'm sticking to, because now you're talking about it, I actually have seen that incredible loyalty. Yeah. So you have worked in the industry for a while, and you've also seen brands that used to appeal to younger people that don't any longer. Without giving away names and numbers, what are the mistakes that you see people making?
I think the biggest mistake is not onboarding the younger consumer through your marketing. And the second biggest is protecting price. We are very protective of bread and butter's price point. In the US, it's between $12 and $15. I review every promotional thing to make sure that we stay in a healthy state, because I have seen brands start to dip below and they get close to $9.99, and the younger consumer believes there is value in the $12 to $15 price segment. That is where they go for their everyday wine. You know, there's nothing telling them this, but they think it's a better quality of wine. Obviously, for bread and butter, we believe it is. But, you know, it's just true. Like, price matters. And if you start to dip below $10, you know, I think you start losing appeal with the up and coming millennial drinker, especially those who are affluent and have the means to buy in 12 to 15.
And you said onboarding. How do you onboard? Because this is what everybody wants to know. How do you onboard the new consumer?
So the first thing for bread and butter is our content is incredibly successful with those consumers. I already talked about it, like we do research that tests it, but we also test it through our social media platform. Anything that goes out at first, we don't put spend behind, and we see how consumers engage with it. Do they like it? Do they share it? And if it is a well-performing post, then we put it into our ad campaigns, and we are highly, highly targeted in the US with our media. We do gear it to a younger consumer. We do go after consumers who buy our competitive brands. But, you know, again, like we're going after that Gen Z. We're going after that millennial. And yes, I agree that some of Gen Z is still on the younger side. Obviously, we do not market to people under the age of 21, but we start at 24 because we want to drive that relevance with them. And even if they are light buyers now for bread and butter, they could be heavy buyers in 5 to 10 years.
And in terms of packaging, you know, everybody's excited about cans and smaller formats. So you, what are you doing in relation to that?
So again, we're a big global brand and we look at what's working in any given market. In Canada, we have innovated very, very quickly. We've actually innovated into 1.5 liters, which bread and butter is very premium. Yeah, and people said, you won't be able to do it. You won't be able to sell it. And the 1.5s have grown exponentially and have not cannibalized our 750s. Then we have experimented with cans in Canada. We do not put every varietal in a can. We do put the more refreshing white wines because it works best with that format. We would like to see the can industry improve their technology so that there's not as much of a metallic taste. But with high acid wines, we can put them in cans. In the Scandinavian markets, we have a bag in box. We ship wine in a tank to the Nordics. We put it in a bag in box. It's a 2.25 liter, which is three bottles. And that's been successful for us as well. And so, again, like we do look at the markets and what's going on there and what the consumer is asking for and the system, you know, the liquor boards, they might be trying to expand a certain category. And when we feel that bread and butter can achieve and be premium in that category, we respond to that request.
All right. Now, we touched on the fact that you are part of a larger company, and it's a company that's known for its success with private label brands. So how is bread and butter managed? Are you like a separate company? Do you have much contact with the others? And how does a company make sure that your brand and the private label brands don't cannibalize each other?
Obviously, for bread and butter, we believe we have built a distinct brand and we invest in it in a meaningful way across marketing, the way we build the brand, you know, from a product perspective. And so we feel like even other brands that are not private label cannot compete with us because we are proud and we believe we're doing it better than everyone else. But in terms of the private label, I work closely, you know, with a team that manages that and I'm aware of everything that's happening. Of course, with our private labels, we want them to be distinct as well, but they really rely on like in-market, in-store programming to build those brands. While again, for bread and butter, we're investing in a more meaningful way in a larger marketing ecosystem to help drive that differentiation.
Okay, so final question. You're talking about the world. You're talking about the Nordics, about South America, about distribution channels. You're seeing it all. As you know, lots of people are looking for bright spots right now. Where do you see the bright spots?
I think I said it before and I come back to it all the time, but we have lost occasions in the consumer's mind for wine, and those can be regained if we market to them and we speak to them in a way that makes wine accessible again. Like, again, get wine back to every dinner table. That is a great goal for the wine industry and will be meaningful from a volume perspective. And I think that alone will drive meaningful growth. I always say, like, people drink wine in good times and bad times. And it's just a little bit of a hard time right now. But again, through Bread and Butter's leadership, I think if other brands start marketing to the consumer in a different way.
You know, this is really interesting, the dinner time one, because that has punched a hole in the wine industry. But it's done that because people aren't sitting down to dinner any longer. So do you think it's possible to rebuild those rituals? It's interesting. Do you think the wine trade should go after a ritual that itself is disappearing? Or is there another way to do it?
I actually, from what I've seen in the consumer research, think people are coming back to community and they're looking for it after it's been lost in COVID. And even like I've seen like running clubs or, you know, different types of clubs. I saw a club that was like inviting me to go read my book silently next to someone else just because they want that community. So I do think people are wanting joy. I see it in the data. I see it in the way they respond to Bread and Butter's marketing. They are wanting community too. And I don't think the dinner occasion has been lost. I just think wine needs to regain it. And I think, you know, across the board, all CPG companies could celebrate coming together at dinner again. And I'm married to a European. He wants to sit down to dinner, and I've been bringing that back into my community, and, you know, it's joyful for me.
Well, on that very positive note, I'd like to thank you so much, Caitlin.
Thank you. This is fun.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.